Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Young, it's Here and Now. The investigation into the outing of CIA agent Valerie Plame is reportedly revisiting the role of both Vice President Dick Cheney and his aide, Scooter Libby, while raising questions about the White House march to war in Iraq. President Bush focused on the war today, as well as on the global war on terrorism. This morning, the president spoke to the Joint Armed Forces Officers' Wives Luncheon in Washington, where he vowed that insurgents won't win.
They target nations whose behavior they believe they can change through violence. Against such an enemy, there is only one effective response. We will never back down, never give in, and never accept anything less than complete victory.
The president made his comments on the war amid potentially blockbuster news regarding the Plame case. Today's New York Times reports that notes of a previously undisclosed conversation indicate that Louis Libby, the vice president's chief of staff, first learned who Valerie Plame was from his boss, Dick Cheney. And that contradicts what Libby told the grand jury, as well as what Cheney has said on news talk shows. Well, joining us on the line to parse all of this, New York Daily News White House correspondent Ken Bazinet. Ken, welcome.
Thank you.
As well as Stephen Hess, professor of media and public affairs at George Washington University. He's also senior fellow emeritus at the Brookings Institution. Stephen, welcome as well.
Thank you.
And Ken, let's remind ourselves, CIA agent Valerie Plame, the wife of former Ambassador Joseph Wilson. Wilson discounted White House claims of weapons of mass destruction. This current investigation is looking to see if anyone in the White House leaked her name as retribution. So what did Louis Scooter Libby tell the grand jury about how he heard Plame's name?
Well, based on legal sources as well as other witnesses who sort of interpret, you know, from the questions they're asked by the special prosecutor, Patrick Fitzgerald, as well as the grand jury, he originally testified that he received the information from journalists. So you can imagine that the New York Times overnight story, which is indeed a blockbuster and much needed from that newspaper at this point, I might add, really throws a wrench into the whole story. You have also the vice president, as you so accurately pointed out, saying during past interviews publicly that he had no knowledge of Valerie Plame and very little knowledge of Joseph Wilson and his trip.
And now we should remind ourselves again, these purported notes that are discussed in today's New York Times say that Libby heard from Dick Cheney Plame's name months before he appeared on Meet the Press, saying that he never heard of Joseph Wilson.
And I will tell you one thing that I know from sources inside the White House. Scooter Libby is an avid note taker. He's already written at least one novel, and he had plans to do more writing afterwards. And at least one very good source, and someone I might add who has testified in front of the grand jury, noted that there was speculation at one time that he was looking forward to writing some kind of a spy novel afterwards. So it's the fact that the New York Times is citing a set of notes does check out with Libby's M.O.
Well, and you mentioned in passing a reference to the New York Times not doing the reporting you'd like to see. You are at a rival paper, but also the Times has been criticized because Judith Miller, a reporter at the Times, is at the center of this as well. She's the one who had some exchanges with Scooter Libby. But, Stephen, I want to just check in with you because we hasten to say these reported leaks today in the Times are from lawyers, perhaps with their own agenda. There have been no leaks that we know of from the Fitzgerald investigation. Your thoughts, on this?
Well, the first thought is that Mr. Fitzgerald seems to be conducting, on one level, one of the most honorable investigations of this sort, in that, unlike Ken Starr, there haven't been a skillion leaks coming out. But the irony of that is that because we don't have all of this type of material coming at us, we in Washington, the inside the Beltway people who really care about this story, have really gone wild with their own speculations. So in a strange way, the fact that the prosecutor is being quite honorable in keeping confidential information confidential has heightened the I wouldn't say misinformation. I have no idea the non-information on this story.
Well, but you say we're the only ones who care about it. Ken, I want you to weigh in on that because it's feeling as if this is becoming less a story about who outed a CIA agent and more a story about what was happening in the White House in the run-up to the war.
This is. I'm glad that you made that point. I think that for a while Steve was absolutely right that this was purely an inside the Beltway story. But when you measure exactly all the facts, when you consider that WIG, the White House Iraq group, was set up to market and sell a war based on Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction.
And let me stop you there. WIG is the group of maybe eight or so who that were based in Dick Cheney's office.
Right. There are sort of conflicting reports who chaired it, but I mean, it was a group originally set up by Andy Card, President Bush's chief of staff, and the players include Karl Rove, Scooter Libby, Karen Hughes, Mary Matlin, Jim Wilkerson, Nick Callio, that's a name that not many people are familiar with. He does legislative liaison work for the White House. Condi Rice and Steve Hadley, who replaced Condi Rice as the National Security Advisor to the President. It's a formidable group. There's an awful lot of brain power there, and there's an awful lot of Washington power there.
Well, and their job, as you say, was to set strategy in the run-up to the war, but isn't that something that's legitimate in a White House that is gearing to perhaps go to war to be able to communicate that to the people? What's wrong with that in your mind?
Absolutely nothing wrong with it. I think the clear problem is after the fact, when you had an entire unit of soldiers as well as Marines who were in Iraq after the successful invasion, their only task was to find WMD. They had a reporter attached to them, by the way, and of course that was Judith Miller, and no WMD has turned up, obviously. Therein lies the problem. You also can pick any number of Bush speeches or Vice President Cheney speeches, and you will see all of a sudden the argument has morphed into, well, Saddam was a bad guy, he had to be deposed.
Well, but I want to stop you there because, Stephen, just to picking up on what Ken was saying earlier, the criticism of WIG, the White House Iraq group, is that they were planning strategy for war at a time when the intelligence was not even fully gathered yet. I mean, that's some of the criticism of that group. What's your take on this?
Well, let's go back a stage. This is the reason we're having this discussion at all today, the reason we are waiting for a special prosecutor to tell us what the crimes are, is not directly connected to this. It's indirectly connected. It has to do whether someone in the United States government violated the 1982 Intelligence Identities Protection Act. This was an act that was set up to protect operatives, not analysts, but operatives, who, as in the case of a bureau chief in Athens, had been assassinated. Now that's a crime. A prosecutor was set up to find out whether the crime had been committed. That's really what this is supposed to be all about. Did Stuart? Well, Scooter Libby, if indeed, since he spoke to reporters and has admitted it, did Karl Rove, who's admitted talking to reporters, know that they were breaking this law, know that Joseph Wilson's wife was a operative, a covert agent of the FBI? If they did, they broke the law. And presumably, that's what we should be the prosecutor should be telling us at the end of the week, whether there was a group in the White House who were trying to sell the war. Well, of course there was. That was what they were trying to do. That was their policy and their objective. So we've come a long way from what we were looking for, and I think that's too bad, in a sense, because we've spent a lot of money and a lot of time. Everything that we just heard about what the government is up to, including exaggerating their case, we've known up to that point. What this case initially was all about is malicious gossip.
But some would say that what it has become is revelations about what was happening in the White House in the run-up to war. For instance, Newsweek's Michael Isikoff writing, when we see now the notes that were exchanged between between Scooter Libby and Judith Miller, the New York Times reporter. Isikoff writes, Libby clearly and unequivocally misrepresented the contents of intelligence regarding the war. And so that, Ken, do you agree with Isikoff that that is maybe not an intended result, but that's been one of the results of this investigation?
Certainly. And let me just say that Stephen Hess is a person who is far smarter than I could ever imagine to be. And that said, let me take his argument apart. Number one, you have WIG, which was set up to do this, as we described earlier. They were set up to market it. The problem is that within that group, you have people who are involved in the leak. You also have information going to that group that ultimately identifies not only Valerie Plame as a CIA employee, but at least one document showing that she's a covert agent. Now a question is who saw that document? The second point I would make is that Fitzgerald's probe, and this is documented in court legal papers, which he's posted on his website. His website went up on last Friday, where it's very plainly stated that his investigation has now broadened to the point of looking into the falsified documents which claimed that Saddam Hussein had sought yellow cake uranium used in the manufacture of nuclear weapons in Niger. So it's very clear that, you know, this investigation may have begun as a leak, or as Stephen put it, a rumor into who was talking about whom and what were they saying and what was their job. But it's very clear now that this has expanded and the court system has signed off on it into an investigation that actually looks at, you know, the work that Joe Wilson, Valerie Plame's husband, was doing in Niger.
I want to get Stephen Hess in here. Stephen, I don't know if you feel as if your argument has been taken apart, but I do want to give you the last minute to comment on that, but also on a report today from UPI that Patrick Fitzgerald has now widened his investigation to include the forged documents on the African uranium, which are at the heart of all of this. That's what everybody was talking about behind the scenes when Valerie Plame's name was outed. Now Fitzgerald's taking a look at them. So your thoughts?
Well, I certainly can wait till the end of the week, which is the grand jury goes out of business on Friday, and so we assume that Patrick Fitzgerald will then tell us what this is all about and what the indictments are. I would say that if the indictments are not for breaking this law, this 1982 law, which is why it was set up, I would be very disappointed, because it would be another case where we are really into process indictments. Another case of setting in motion a prosecutor, giving him enough time and money until he comes up with a crime. I hope that won't happen. I think this is a very responsible prosecutor, but I'll wait to see.
Stephen Hess, professor of media and public affairs at George Washington University, also senior fellow emeritus at the Brookings Institution. We've also been speaking with White House correspondent Ken Bazinet. He's with the New York Daily News. It's a conversation that you may be the only one willing to wait, Steve, because everyone else is wanting to weigh in on it. Thank you both for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Stay with us. Much more ahead, including Who is Scooter Libby? You're listening to Here and Now. It's Here and Now. So who is Irving Lewis Scooter Libby, the central figure in the investigation into the Valerie Plame case, and it's being revealed into the White House push for war in Iraq? Michael Cranish is Washington correspondent for the Boston Globe. He's been looking into that question. He joins us now. Michael, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And we should say, of course, Scooter Libby, Dick Cheney's chief of staff, and a definitive neoconservative in that, as you write, he was once a left-leaning, anti-war, pro-Eugene McCarthy liberal.
Well, I found that to be interesting. Scooter Libby went to prep school right near where you're speaking from, and that is in Massachusetts. He went to Phillips Academy at Andover, which, of course, is where both President Bush's went to school. And he also went to Yale. But when he was at Andover, according to his classmates, he was a supporter of Eugene McCarthy in 1968, McCarthy, of course, being the anti-war candidate. And also, if you look in the yearbook for 1968, you'll see it lists Scooter Libby as the vice president of the Student Democrats. So clearly that's where he was coming from. And a lot of neoconservatives are like that. That's one of the reasons they call them neo or new conservatives. They started out in one spectrum, more liberal, and then became more conservative or neoconservative as they went along. And Scooter Libby, it's interesting, when he went on to Yale, just as both Bushes also did, a professor named Paul Wolfowitz took him under his wing. And, of course, Paul Wolfowitz later became the official who Libby worked with in this Bush administration.
Right.
They've known each other for a very long period of time, and they're both leaders of what's called the neoconservative movement.
From student and professor, they became colleagues. They wrote together a paper after the first President Bush allowed Saddam Hussein to remain in power after the Gulf War. They were against that. And then with other disenchanted liberals and, as you said, neocons such as William Kristol, they formed the Project for the New American Century. You write that this group, again, formed long before 9/11, is viewed as a launching pad for the later invasion of Iraq, and Scooter Libby a part of it. Tell us about that.
Well, one of the premises of that group and similar organizations like that was to basically promote the idea that the U.S. did not always have to act unilaterally. You recall during the first Gulf War, the first President Bush was very proud of the fact that he had a broad coalition, but a lot of people thought that was wonderful. Some of the neoconservatives, however, thought that that was not the U.S. asserting its power forcefully enough. And so one of the points of this group and others like it was that the U.S. will need to act alone and should turn its cheek to the U.N. if necessary and take action. And this group was composed of a number of people from the first Bush administration who did not agree with the decision to allow Saddam Hussein to remain in power. So they can't simply go form a group and call a press conference and say, let's go invade Iraq. They had to promote some more broad rationale for it. They didn't know what would happen in the future. But this was the thesis working for that group, and Iraq was certainly, most definitely, one of the things on their mind. And the group included Scooter Libby. He was one of the group, the persons that formed the group.
In fact, he went on, as we said, to become chief of staff for Dick Cheney and joined the White House Iraq group, which we just spoke of. This group, which was charged with strategy for selling the war to the American people. Not uncommon in a White House, but how uncommon was the way he went about it? I mean, we hear about late night phone calls pressuring the State Department. What did you find out?
Well, first of all, you have to understand that Scooter Libby is so close to Dick Cheney. One of Cheney's aides described him as being sort of Cheney's Cheney, as close to Cheney is to the president. And Scooter Libby is a lawyer. He represented a billionaire fugitive named Mark Rich, a very controversial person. And so in his private career, he's used to representing very controversial causes. People described him to me as not a fiery ideologue so much as someone who was absolutely devoted to Paul Wolfowitz, who was at the Defense Department, very much one of the key promoters of the Iraq War, and so very loyal to Dick Cheney. So I don't know that he would be out there freelancing. Everything that I've heard leads me to believe that he's doing the vice president's bidding. Now, the question is, how far do you go in doing that bidding? Do you go beyond perhaps what Cheney intended? I think we'll all be interested to see what comes up with the indictments from that. And he was involved with what's called the White House Iraq Group, or WIGS. We thought WIGS went out a couple of centuries ago, but the WIGS are back. And that group was very involved in selling the Iraq War. Now, obviously, every administration wants to sell its policies. Nothing wrong with that whatsoever. I think the question we're waiting to see answered is whether the prosecutor in this case will determine that this group of individuals had a strategy of leaking classified information. That goes beyond this question of who leaked the name of Valerie Plame as a CIA operative, and was there a broader strategy to leak classified intelligence as a way of justifying the Iraq War.
Well, and if not leak, definitely insinuate, of course, which isn't illegal. As we know, Libby contacted Judith Miller of The Times to try to offset Joseph Wilson's criticism of the intelligence about weapons of mass destruction. And you remind us that Libby was also a published fiction author, and his flair for writing is an apparent in his notes to her. He writes about, we've spoken of this, of the aspen leaves turning, very poetic. But Michael,
in clusters.
In clusters.
That was the suggestion that there was some kind of a signal, and no one knows whether there really was or wasn't except
right,
them.
But he also writes in that note, as Michael Isikoff points out, that just you wait and see. Don't worry. There's still secret stuff out there that will prove we were right all along. This was shortly before that intelligence was discounted. You got about a minute to comment on that, Michael.
Well, there's still some in the administration who believe that somewhere there are weapons of mass destruction. Clearly, a lot of people thought that they were. John Kerry, among them, thought that there were weapons. A lot of Democrats did. A lot of people at a certain time thought that there were. There were plenty of skeptics. The argument really for a lot of people was, should they wait before they go invade Iraq? Should they give the inspectors another 6 weeks or whatever? So far, obviously, they've not been found. It's a great embarrassment to this administration. The president has acknowledged that they've not been found. There's some who still think they will be proven right. There's some authors out there who still think they're there. But so far, they just haven't turned up. You think they would have by now.
Michael Cranish, a Washington correspondent for the Boston Globe, speaking with us about Vice President Dick Cheney's chief of staff, Scooter Libby, very much the man at the center of attention in the Valerie Plame story today. And in the few seconds we have, Michael, not a place Scooter Libby ever wanted to be. He is not a man who seeks the limelight.
He really wanted to be behind the scenes, the opposite of Karl Rove. A lot of people probably never heard of him until recently, and he wanted to stay in the shadows. Obviously, that's not the way it's worked out.
Michael Cranish, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And obviously, we'll continue to follow this story, the grand jury wrapping up the investigation on Friday. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Funding for Here, It's Here and Now. When outgoing Federal Reserve Chair Alan Greenspan wants to check the pulse of the American economy, he turns to FedEx. Quite literally. Greenspan frequently weighs in with FedEx founder Fred Smith at Washington Redskins games because their boxes are right next to each other, but also because Greenspan believes the number of packages FedEx delivers every day are a good sign of how strong the U.S. economy is. New York Times reporter David Leonhardt has called this the FedEx economy, and David joins us now on the line. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
And could you explain this in a little more detail? What is a FedEx economy? What does that mean?
Absolutely. The FedEx economy is an economy that reacts very quickly to unexpected events. And my favorite example of that are the 5 empty FedEx planes that fly over the United States every night, circling, basically just to stop off at an airport and pick up extra packages or bail out a broken plane, and then continue those packages on their route to delivery.
Now, these are called the flying spares.
Yes, these are the flying spares, and there are 5 of them. They take off from the same cities every night, and they fly these circuitous routes that aren't designed to get anywhere quickly, but instead are designed to pass over as many major cities as possible, so they're available to help out in Dallas or Denver or Miami or Atlanta.
It's an illustration of, as you say, a system that constantly recalibrates itself to cope with surprises.
That's right. The morning that I spent at FedEx, one of the planes that takes off from Florida had landed in Atlanta, not because the plane in Atlanta was broken, but because it had been a really busy day in the Atlanta economy, and they had more packages to ship than they usually do for reasons that weren't clear. So they ordered the plane to land in Atlanta at some point when it was over Alabama. It did. It picked up the packages, quickly brought them to Memphis, and then they were on their way the next morning. Nearly all large companies do a lot more of this than they used to. It used to take days or weeks for them to find out that maybe there'd been a slowdown in orders. And by the time they found out, they had already built up lots of extra, say, boxes of toothpaste in their warehouse. And then they realized, wait a minute, demand for toothpaste is slowing. We need to rapidly cut our production because we're going to have to sell all this extra toothpaste we have sitting in our warehouse.
And by the way, that means lay off workers.
Precisely. Now, what happens is they may find out literally that day that less toothpaste is selling in Walmart than they expected, and so they're going to ship less of it to Walmart, and it just keeps the swings a lot smaller. Now, it doesn't mean the swings don't exist. You may remember that in the 90s, people said things like, we've reformed the business cycle, we'll never have recessions again, and that's simply not true, but we have had many fewer of them in the last 20 years than in the 20 years before that, and the ones we've had have been less violent. There is a price to all this, but there are also a lot of benefits.
What's the price, by the way?
Not only is the economy more flexible, but it's also less certain. And so there are more part-time workers who may be asked to work extra hours at FedEx when the economy is busy, but that means it's more difficult for them to plan on how many hours they're going to have the following week. And there's better technology that helps us be a lot more productive, but that also means there are fewer jobs.
Is this why the economy in general is doing so well, and yet there are still concerns about workers?
That's right. That's exactly what's going on. That if you think about what's gone on in the economy in the last 5 years, we have had what our article called an almost biblical series of calamities, right? We've had hurricanes, we've had 2 wars, we've had 9/11, we've had financial scandals. It's just one thing after another. And yet,
this economy has been growing without interruption, essentially, since the end of 2001. And that's sort of remarkable. But on the other hand, job growth has also been considerably weaker than it has been in past expansions.
Well, because you also mentioned, I want to make sure we point out, you say there haven't been major recessions, but there are these micro or mini recessions where maybe even off our radar, companies adjust to, as you said, how production's going.
Right. So when companies do notice that things are slowing down, they'll pull back their own production a little bit. They won't pull it back as sharply as they did in the past, but they'll pull it back a little bit. And when you have enough of that going on, you have what we call mini-recessions or micro-recessions. And if you think about it, you may recall that Alan Greenspan and Ben Bernanke, his likely successor, have used the words soft patch to describe what's going on in the economy. And some of your listeners may remember fears in the last few years that we were going to slip back into recession. And what was actually going on there is we were going through one of these mini recessions, but businesses recalibrated and it didn't become the real thing.
You mentioned Ben Bernanke. That's President Bush's nominee to replace Alan Greenspan when his expected retirement occurs in January. But do you think that if he becomes the next chair of the Federal Reserve, he will, you know, during Washington Redskins games, go check in with Fred Smith to see how FedEx is doing, to see how the economy's doing?
Mr. Bernanke is a baseball fan and apparently has some quite detailed opinions about good and bad baseball statistics. I don't know whether he's a football fan, but I am pretty sure that the Fed under him will continue to use FedEx as well as UPS and some of these other large companies as important barometers, because if you think about it, there just aren't that many companies that have the view into the U.S. economy that FedEx does, both in terms of its breadth, I mean, they've got a hand in every industry in the country, and in terms of the timeliness of their information. I mean, they can tell day-to-day whether the economy's picking up or slowing down. And there is one big downside, besides the ones I was mentioning earlier, which is you can get lulled into a sense that we've gotten so flexible that there's no such thing as risk, there's no such thing as likelihood of recession, or no such thing of likelihood of bubble. And if when you get lulled into that sense, you nearly assure that we're going to have some sort of bad economic event.
Well, I'm wondering if there's another danger, David Leonhardt, and that is that FedEx relies on planes and oil. And in the economy that we seem to be heading for, flying, you know, envelopes around the world, seems like something we may not be able to afford.
I think that's a good question. I mean, I do think that if we're dealing with permanently higher oil prices or higher oil prices for the foreseeable future, it is going to complicate a business like that. I think what will end up happening is that things like letters will become much less likely to be sent through FedEx. And in fact, the Internet has already made that happen. But the Internet also vastly increases the number of transactions that happen through a FedEx or through a UPS. So I would imagine that even with oil prices high, there will still be a lot of purchases that will be cheaper to do through Amazon or eBay than they will be at your local mall, which, if you think about it, you have to drive to anyway.
So, David, major economists are using the FedEx as sort of an economic indicator. Would you explain to me why it is that they're so good? Because I once had to send a FedEx from, you know, Cambridge, Massachusetts, 2 miles away to Boston, and I learned that my package would be flown to Memphis and then turned around and flown back to Boston. I can't see the efficiency in that.
Yeah, and it's interesting you say that, because they now do that less often than they used to. They've developed more local miniature hubs that prevent them from having to route absolutely everything for Memphis. There are still a lot of packages that go through Memphis that never would if they were simply crows trying to fly from A to B. And I think the reason for that is that when you build up a large enough network, it can be efficient not to do things in the most direct way. I'm sure you have some things in your house that you pick it up and you see Made in China on the back, and you think to yourself, how is it possible that this tiny little item, which I bought for $2 and maybe cost 48 cents to make, is worth flying here from China or sending on a boat here from China? And the answer is, you make enough of them, inexpensively enough, and it's worth even sending relatively inexpensive things long distances.
David Leonhardt, a reporter for the New York Times, who wrote about the FedEx economy and caught our eye. David, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And you're listening to Here and Now. The the founding symbol of the civil rights movement, is dead. Rosa Parks, who sparked the drive for equal rights for blacks when she refused to surrender her seat on a city bus to a white man in Alabama back in 1955, died yesterday in Detroit. She was 92. Joining us now with her reflections on Rosa Parks is Lani Guinier. She was nominated by President Clinton to be the first African-American woman to head the Civil Rights Division in the U.S. Justice Department. Her nomination caused such an outcry from conservatives that her name was withdrawn. Guinier is now a professor at Harvard Law School. And Professor Guinier, what did Rosa Parks mean to you?
Her story has remained inspirational, not only for me, but for many people who did much more than me and much earlier than I did in the civil rights movement. I mean, her story was pivotal, even though it's been widely misunderstood. Many people think that she was an isolated woman who just got tired one day, but she was active with the local NAACP chapter, and she had been to the Highlander School in Tennessee, where people were being trained to resist injustice. And December 1st, 1955 was her time.
Yeah. She was an activist. And as you say, for some, it was a more, a better story if she was just a little old lady who had a spontaneous moment. What did it mean to you, Lani Guinier, that she was an activist?
Well, it means two things. One, that it is really important for people to see themselves as part of a collective, a community, an organized response, because it's very hard to do anything by yourself. And number two, it says that the media, although it was in some ways the unpaid volunteers of the civil rights movement, also helped to distort the civil rights movement by focusing on individuals as if they were lone rangers or heroes, in a way that ignores the support that she got from the black community, and particularly from the black women in Montgomery.
Lani Guinier, you were not unfamiliar with injustice in your family. I find it fascinating that you became the first black woman to become a tenured professor at Harvard Law School. Your father, though, had gone to Harvard in, what, the 30s?
In the 1929.
And had left. Why?
Well, he left because Harvard refused to give him any scholarship aid on the grounds they claimed that he had failed to submit a photograph with his application. And the real story was that Harvard had a quota of one black student per class, and he was number two.
Right. And we understand the white students didn't speak to him. He wasn't called on. As you
right.
said, wasn't allowed
including
to live.
Including by people that he had known when he was a student at Boston English High School.
As I said, your family has some familiarity with the kinds of things that Rosa Parks was addressing. And I'm just wondering, do you think black families are going to be gathering together today to talk about this woman? I mean, how much of an impact do you think her passing?
Well, it's the end of an era, but it's also a reminder that many of the injustices that she experienced at a very visible and overt level are still around. They're just much more covert, and we still need people willing to resist, but to resist in a way that turns their grievances into a larger cause with which many people can identify. And I think that's really her great accomplishment.
Lani Guinier, professor at Harvard Law School, commenting on the passing of Rosa Parks. Did you ever meet her?
Yes. It was in 1993. It was right after my own, quote, disappointment with the nomination to be Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights. And there was the 30th anniversary of the August 1963 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. And she and I were both allowed to stand on the dais. Neither of us spoke, but I got a chance to have my picture taken with her, and it was just, it just felt in the same way that the black women in Montgomery had stood up for her when she refused to get up, I felt that she was standing up for me and for the cause of civil rights, really not personal, but for those of us who don't back down from principle.
Lani Guinier, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Sure.
Stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now. It's Here and Now. TV viewers might recognize writer Stephen Belber's name from the credits for Law and Order Special Victims Unit or Dennis Leary's Rescue Me. But Belber is also a playwright who deals with difficult topics. The Laramie Project focused on the homophobic murder of Matthew Shepard in Wyoming. Tape dealt with date rape. Now Belber's newest work, Carol Mulroney, in production at the Huntington Theater Company here in Boston. It's a dark comedy in which the central character, Carol, spends most of her time on the roof of her apartment building. As we hear in this edited excerpt, it's a place that both exhilarates and frightens her.
Because I feel like I have the potential to jump. Is that typical? I don't know. Part of me knows that it is. That it's not uncommon for human beings to have the urge to fall away. And the reason that it freaks me out so much is I don't like having that urge. My natural instinct, I think, is to connect with people, but it never seems to work out for me. And consequently, much as I love a roof, my roof, whenever I get too near its edge, I get that urge.
And playwright Stephen Belber joins us in the studio with more about his new play, Carol Mulroney. Stephen, welcome.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So I'm thinking once you've explored date rape, murderous hate crimes, suicide might seem the next logical step.
Yes, but they're all comedies is sort of the key there.
Well, I wanted to point that out and make it clear. You know, we're not talking about a Eugene O'Neill tone here.
People. No, because I think those issues, they find their way into our everyday. And the way that we live our everyday is imbued with humor constantly. And mm-hmm. it's the way we deal with these things. And it started with the Laramie Project. Going out there, it was such an intense experience to go out to Laramie that I think the company sort of quickly resorted to a particular type of humor. Mm-hmm. To offset the intensity of all these interviews and what we were discovering.
Right. The Laramie Project was interviews with real-life people in the area about what they thought of the Matthew Shepard murder, and then that was turned into the play, the onstage play. And we understand you were one of the actors in the play, and mm-hmm. you stood on stage for a great deal of the end of the play.
Yes.
And so that's when this new work, Carol Mulroney, was born. How did that happen?
There's a long section there where, at the end of the Laramie Project, Matthew Shepard's father gives a speech in the courtroom, and the rest of the company, the ensemble, is on stage having to stay very still. And I happen to have been placed up front center, sort of, and I was fidgety. I'm a fidgety guy, I think. And so I had to concentrate heavily on something else. And the conception of this play definitely came out of my experience in Laramie, where I was constructing personalities. At first, I couldn't interview the killers. I wasn't allowed because of a media blackout. And So I really had to construct these personalities from interviews with their family, friends, everybody around them. And I started thinking about how well do we know one another? Mm. And that these personality sort of exists based on the differing relationships that person has. And if you start to question or tinker with those relationships, what does that leave you with? How well do you know what you're left with?
Well, and when it comes to the character that came out of that thinking, Carol Mulroney, not well, it turns out, because there's a satellite group of characters that, you know, revolve around her, come up on the roof to see her, her father, Hutton, who owns a cosmetic company, her husband, Leslie, her best friend, Joan, her perhaps potential lover, Ken, who works with Leslie at mm-hmm. Carol's father's cosmetic company. And they all are missing valuable information about her.
It's true. I think the connections that each one of those people have with her start to become frayed at the edge, and that's where we meet Carol. And she's trying to reconnect with all these vital relationships in her life. And when those things all become frayed at the same time, I think it does sort of shake up a personality, and it makes you question sort of who you are fundamentally when you can't refract yourself off of other people.
What are you saying about roofs? The roof is the whole staging is the roof, mm-hmm. pretty much.
They're the root of all evil, roofs.
roofs.
No, I do think that in a city, in a crowded city, be it New York, Boston, anywhere, that finding a quiet place and a place of solace is very difficult, and people do retreat to the roofs often. I find it, for me, it's incredibly beautiful up there, and the lights of a city are peaceful. And when you get down up close to the city, it can be brutal, and right. it can be overwhelming. And so that's where Carol goes, up to this roof, to find a little peace and attempt to figure out these questions she has.
Let's listen to a scene. In this one, Carol's father, Hutton, comes to tell her she must choose who gets the next big job at his company, Leslie, or her husband, or her potential lover, Ken. Let's listen.
Whoever gets a job is virtually assured to someday run the company. It's a major opportunity.
And you're leaving it up to me?
I would like to sound you out as to your future so that I might make my choice accordingly.
My future?
Yes.
Dad!
I know what you're thinking.
No, you don't.
Thinking, you don't have to do this.
No, I'm not.
Well, I don't, but I want to. I want to know what you want.
Who I want?
Yes.
And you think that'll make me happy by hiring the boy I like?
So, Stephen Pilber, everybody seems to be trying, Carol seems to be trying to figure out what would make her happy. Why is she unhappy? She doesn't feel unhappy because she's such an appealing character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I started the play and I had to sort of admit to myself that there was an inexplicable sadness to her. And I think it's my theory that I think a lot of human beings have a corner, a small section of them that is sad. I sort of wanted to focus on that because I think it's, as one of the characters says later, sadness in our culture is devalued and it's sort of looked at as a great flaw. And so why Carol is sad is, in a more practical answer to that, is because she wants to play by the rules. She wants to be happy. She wants to have a good relationship with her father. She wants to have a great marriage. She's a person who's always trying and grasping for the golden ring of happiness. And in this case, on this day, missing by fractions.
Or, you know, some would say in your writing, grabbing the ring of happiness, and it meant jumping off the building. I mean, there's a chance it could be interpreted that way, that in fact for her that was happiness. So what are you saying about suicide?
Well, I'm not saying that. I think there are characters who voice that opinion in the play. We see the characters who are in her life trying to understand and grapple with why she did this, and one of them puts forth this notion that maybe it was right for her and maybe that made sense, and in that way I choose to believe that she fell in order to ascend, is what he says. And I certainly don't advocate that. I think there is a, you know, sometimes for people who are extremely sad, I'm sure that that's the logic that they're employing. I don't know. I'm not advocating in any sense because I do believe there are solutions. But I also know that answer, the idea that there is no answer, and then the only answer is to fall away and to you, that this time you missed the train. I think that's the logic employed by a lot of suicidal people.
Hmm. Once again, a work from playwright Stephen Pilber that's going to get people talking about an issue, in this case, suicide. You also write extensively for television for Law and Order, SVU for Rescue Me. As a playwright, I just want to ask you, what's one of the strangest storylines that you had to sort of craft for television? Because, hey, that's where the bread and butter is.
Well, I guess there was a Law and Order episode where it sort of came down from above that we were supposed to write about. Pee-wee Herman had been arrested again for collecting erotic art. And a question of, is erotic art porn, or is it just beautiful pieces of art? And so I was delving into the research on this and trying to get it, because there are interesting issues there. And then suddenly it came down from above again that the same episode was also to incorporate a JonBenet Ramsey element to it.
Missing child element.
Yeah, missing child, but also beauty queen and the beauty pageant circuit that she was on and how what that does to kids. So I had to sort of combine the Pee-wee erotic art with the JonBenet Ramsey.
And then did you get a call? But wait, there's been a hurricane.
Well, there were a couple more little twists and turns, and Law and Order is very good at doing its twists and turns. But that was a hard one to incorporate those elements. And you know, you don't want to offend Pee-wee. If I ever run into him, I didn't want to take it verbatim.
So retreating to the stage. Even if the topic's suicide, must be
well. You do. You don't. You get to make up what you want to do, and you can pick and choose in ways that make sense, as opposed to ways that are needed for other reasons. Let's just put it that way.
Stephen Pilber's new play is called Carol Maroney. It's now at the Huntington Theater here in Boston. Steve, thanks so much for coming in to talk about it.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
And Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.